Accession number 27083, Rule 68.
I'm sorry, Sir Henry, you are referring to the fact you lived next door in the old house.
Yes, and we had one of those whirligig things for drying the laundry. And the nylon strings had got rather slack, and I was refitting that. And I wasn't really paying too much attention to what I was doing. And I had to put quite a lot of pressure on one of these strings to get it taut again. And I put so much pressure on that I parted it. And I drove my right knuckle very sharply, it was a very good blow actually, straight into my right eye. And it hurt a bit. And I could physically feel it swelling up. However, there it was. And when I finished this job, I popped into the loo to have a look. And it was already turning various colours of the rainbow and was very swollen and pretty well closed up. And next day I had to appear at the cenotaph, and it would take a certain amount of explanation, to say the least. Well, I got away with all that until, as was customary, after the cenotaph celebration, a ceremony was complete. We all went back into the FCO and had a glass of grog. And then various government members, including the Prime Minister and the Defence Secretary, and the Chiefs of Staff, went off to have lunch, a delightful informal lunch, with the Bishop of London. As I entered the reception in the FCO, there was Peter Carrington, the Foreign and Commonwealth Secretary. When it came to shaking people by the hand in the usual way, and when it came to shaking me, and we knew each other, of course, he took one look at my my black eye and stepped back and said, in a very loud, clear voice, "Oh no! Oh no! I can't believe it! It was John Knott." And John Knott was standing half a dozen paces away. And there it was. So we all had a good laugh about that. The time came for me to go, and by now it was firmly fixed that I was going to haul off on the 1st of December, a date not of my choosing, but of John Knott's choosing, because he really wanted to have enough of me. And as he told me at one of these conversations at Shrivenham, he said he'd had to fight quite hard to prevent the Prime Minister from sacking me previously. And Knott's line had generously been, "No, he's only got another few months to go. Let him see it through." And he won that one, for which I was duly grateful. And it's interesting to reflect on, although it didn't come out at the time, of course, I had no inkling of that at the time. And the time came for me to pay my final call on him. I can't remember precisely which date it was, but it was against the knowledge that I should leave on the 1st of December. And I debated whether to have a final row, so to speak, with him, because on the stocks at the time was a thing called the Falklands White Paper, the first six chapters of which had recounted, and they'd been drafted by the civil servants, and They covered the run-up to the war itself, and so forth. And that was all old hat, you might say. It was very innocuous stuff. The seventh chapter had been drafted by John Knott and concerned the rather more, with an eye to the future, the rather more tangible aspect of replacements for losses during the war. And frankly, it was a load of rubbish. And I debated whether to have it out with him at the last set too, so to speak, and decided that that was a bit cheap and wouldn't really get me anywhere, because all he had to do was to wait 48 hours or whatever it was until my back was turned, and then I would go unchanged. So I had decided that I would not discuss the Falklands White Paper. At least I wouldn't raise it. And I went in at 6 o'clock or so one evening, and he couldn't have been more charming. He ordered a glass of whiskey for me, and we sat on a sofa. And when the whiskey arrived, he immediately turned to me and said, "What do you think of the Falklands White Paper?" So I had to play to that tune. And I told him what I just told you, that the first six chapters were innocuous and the seventh was a load of crap. And we then proceeded to really go into a drafting session for the seventh chapter. And he was not entirely convinced by everything, I thought, and he was not he wasn't very definitive, but I'd obviously got someone. I pointed out, for instance, because they're still banging on about replacing the Type 21s with Type 21s, which is frankly absurd, and all that sort of thing. I can't remember all the details of it, but we went through it in detail. And I was able to tell him, and I'll return to that in a moment, I was able to tell him that on whichever day the white paper was publicized, I already had five interviews with the media, and provided it was got right, and the amendments that I'd suggested were, or the sense of them was included, that nothing would give me greater pleasure than to say I support the white paper. But the media would be out for blood, and they would be expecting me to say that I disagreed with it, because it was, I disagreed with so much before, and so on. And I said, if you get it right, I will support it, but only if. And with that, really, the meeting ended, and I left. I'll finish that off now. The white paper was publicized about the 10th of December, that sort of time delay. And I arranged a call at the Minister of Defense, and have a brief session with my successor, John Fieldhouse, concerning precisely this, the Defence White Paper. By then, it was public knowledge when the White Paper was coming out, and my five sessions with the media had risen to 11. So it was quite a day. And John Fieldhouse said to me when I asked him that there were one or two things that weren't quite right, but that they were manageable, and the greatest help I could be to him would be to support the white paper. And off I went to do precisely that. And the media were furious. They thought that they were here was a natural rebel who was going to tear it to shreds and so forth. And all I did was to say, and they said, what do you think of this thing? And they called it a thing, Falkland's white paper. And I said, I support the white paper. And they were livid, because there wasn't much more for them to ask me.
No, there's no story.
No story.
No story in agreement.
Until the last media interview I had of the day, and this was with Peter Snow on Newsnight at 11 o'clock, as I recall. And they had tried to get John Knott to take part, but he wouldn't play. And they got, I can't remember his name, quite a well-known conservative backbench MP. And the first part of that interview concerned, which I mentioned in an earlier tape, this business of the controversy over the shape of future frigates, short and fat versus long and thin, and fully breached. I'd been warned that this would come up, and I was determined to kick it to touch once and for all. And so the program started off, and Peter Snow turned to me about this, and I was able to say all the sort of things that I wanted to say, which had the effect of kicking it pretty firmly to touch. And Peter Snow then asked me a question, and unfortunately, because it rather ruins the story, I can't remember precisely what the question was. But it was one of the validity, yes, I think validity is the right word, of the Royal Navy as a whole, and so on. And my answer to it, off the top of my head and without a moment's thought, was, well, after all, England won the Falklands War, so what more do you want to support them? And that was that. And he then turned on some other topic, more akin to the white paper, I think, to the MP. And hardly had he done so when the telephone on the floor by his side buzzed. He picked it up. He spoke for a few moments, put the receiver down, turned to me and said, I think you ought to know now that the entire telephone exchange is jammed with incoming calls of complaint from the Scots, the Welsh, and the Irish in your saying that England won the Falklands War. I will give you a chance to retract that statement before the end of the program. That was that. Well, off he went on with this this MP, to which I had to keep an ear cocked in case I was brought back in again, in the event I wasn't. And I realised that I'd had a bit of a slip of the tongue here, and it was very unfortunate, obviously. But no way was I going to retract it, because if I had, it would have been tantamount to the clock striking 13, and all the good I had done, the boot, the short and fat to touch, would have been suspect. And could I think of a solution, a way out of it? Could I? Hell. And the exchange with the MP ended, and Peter Snow turned back to me and said, now, Admiral, you remember that earlier on you said, and he rehearsed the situation, what would I like to say? And even at that point, I hadn't got the solution. And then it came. So it was a pretty taut-run thing. And I said, during the war, although most of the complainants, no doubt, were too young to have been involved in it, no one. Always take the initiative. But during the war, there was a famous song, and it ran, "There'll always be an England." It did not go, "There'll always be an England and a Scotland and a Wales and a Northern Ireland and blah, blah, blah." It said, "There will always be an England." And everybody took it for the spirit in which it was intended, namely, it was the British Isles and so forth. And that was the spirit in which I made my remark. And I can only say that anybody who interpreted it in a different light must have been very mean and small-minded. And the program closed. And that was that. Afterwards, in the course of the next few days, I got three letters. Two didn't amount to anything. One, barely literate, came from, I don't know who, I think it was, may have been a Welshman, but I don't know, and it doesn't matter. And it said that I was a disgrace, I should be reduced to the rank of midshipman, I should be mastheaded, I should be keel-hauled, tricky if you were mastheaded, but never mind, and that sort of thing. It was six lines, also, I've still got it in my scrapbook. Of utter vituperation. And I wrote a one line, I think, back thanking him for his letter. And that was that. Now, this is, of course, my swan song. And the board and the commanders in chief, this was actually back in late November, I think, they organized a farewell dinner for me on board the good ship Bristol, and she was moored in the, I think she was moored alongside Belfast, probably in the Pool of London. And that was, as it were, the Navy's final send-off. I had one or two dates still to do, and so I knew I was going to be put up to Admiral of the Fleet, and it was quite tricky to get my uniform changed in time, and I shouldn't have put it up until literally the day I left. An interesting reflection, a very generous, in quotes, brackets, sick, close brackets, arrangement, that I was promoted to Admiral of the Fleet at noon on the day I left office. And this was on the presumption that I would have handed over in the course of the forenoon, and therefore they wouldn't have to pay me a single full day's pay at the higher rate. I thought that was average and cheap. But there it was. So I changed my uniform, and I had a super dinner on board Bristol with the board and the commanders-in-chief, and it couldn't have been nicer. And they flew my Union flag illuminated at the masthead, and they did it beautifully. They gave me, as a farewell present, various people said all sorts of undeservedly nice things about me, and they gave me a collection of crests about 4 inches by 3 inches in the shape of shields, with the crests of all the ships that I had ever served in, not commanded, but served in, except one. They left it out. I'd only had a month there, but never mind, that was the Rodney, and I had some difficulty in finding out where they'd got this lot from and getting it replaced afterwards. And those I can't show you, I'm afraid, because they're all in my old house next door, because there's hardly space in this little shack. But it was a very nice occasion, a very nice evening, and they did me proud. And I have to say, we had... Now, whether they think thought the same or not, but I think they weren't far off it. We'd established a very good relationship There was no we and they between myself and any of the board members. I regarded them all as friends and good friends and a marvelous team to work with. And I felt very proud of them. And then on the 1st of December, I left. And by then, I had a new vice chief in the form of Peter Stanford. And he had organized quite properly the naval staff and anybody else. And he had taken a sounding with them. And they, bless them, had said that on this occasion, they wished to wear uniform to see me off. And they hoped that I would do the same. Well, that was easy from my point of view. It was not so easy from theirs, because some of them were in bed sits here and there about London, and they weren't normally required to have uniform in London, so they had to make extra effort. And this was quite a thing for them to have to do, and it was an encumbrance. But they had said, apparently, that that's what they wanted. And of course, I'd handed over de facto to John Fieldhouse by then. And I had, as I recall, I had a gin and tonic in the vice chief's office with the other board members. And then, quite quickly, we have 10 minutes worth. And then the time came for me to go. And my car with my Royal Marines driver, who I was going to keep for my educational and vocational training fortnight that was to follow. And that was a nice gesture. And that was standing by. And the whole of the corridor, and I went down in the lift, and then the whole of the north entrance of the Minister of Defence was absolutely jam-packed with people who had come from far and wide to see me off, and it was a very, very moving occasion. And I, of course, was miserable and could hardly speak and hoped that the tears wouldn't show too much, because it was the end of 45 years active service in the Navy. And it was as simple as that. And somebody somewhere said, call for three chairs. And they cheered like mad. And I rather blindly shuffled into my car and was driven off. And that was the end of that. And felt, absolutely killed, as you might suppose. And the plan was that I should go to my daughter's house and have a quiet family lunch with her. She by then was married. This is my elder daughter, the one who lives next door now, and so on. And I was still trying to recover from all this carry-on. And the driver, tactfully, wasn't attempting to make conversation. And somewhere just beyond Harrods, he suddenly turned off. And by this time, I was partially recovered. And sufficiently alert again to say, what's going on? Where are you going? My daughter's not that way. She's the other way. Sir, he said, I'm afraid you've been kidnapped. And I was taken to, I can't remember exactly what it was called, it was some fairly swept-up hotel just round the corner, where my son-in-law's best man was the manager. And nobody said a word about this to me. And I was shown into a room where an ordinary suit had been laid out for me, and I got out of uniform and taken down And there was not very many, but my daughter and son-in-law. I think that was about it, and of course his best man and so forth. And I was given an absolutely delicious champagne lunch, and then drove home. Was driven home. I found it was quite interesting that it took the best part of a year before, when one woke up in the morning, you didn't grab your alarm clock and start cursing because it hadn't gone off and you thought you'd missed your program and so forth. It took at least that time for me to realize that I didn't actually any longer have to fill every single minute that one could relax. The idea that you rose from the breakfast table and went and sat in a chair and read the newspaper, it didn't ring true. And I couldn't do it. Several times I tried, and I thought, some bit of my conscience pricked. I should be doing something, whether that was weeding the garden or something equally trivial, was another matter. But you can't just sit there sloping. And it took quite a long time to work it out of the system, which is not surprising, I suppose, if we come to think of it, after all that time. And the pace, the going rate had been pretty hot. I think I won't describe my EVT course until we get on to the next bit. My finale on active service. They had a neat form of words in order to avoid paying me. And it was, ceases to be employed in an active service appointment. But as an Admiral of the Fleet, of course, I never retire.
You stay on what Peter Hill Norton called the inactive active list.
That's it.
Yes.
There again, but this will come out later on. It became customary to brief the previous First Sea Lords in a sort of private session by the First Sea Lord of the day, once a year or so, just to keep them up to date on matters of great moment. You couldn't be very extensive. And I realized, of course, that when I cut loose, I would very quickly get out of date. I was amazed at the speed with which this happened, really amazed. And I suppose that was merely an indication of the pace of life in Whitehall. And there it was. But I think we better stop there, and then we'll restart with the various things I did afterwards.
Yes, well, we'll stop after one.
Did you want to ask your questions?
I have some questions, which, yep, I'll turn the tape over for, and we'll come to that because we're near at the end of this tape. But I will just ask one question relating exactly to what you've described, and that is the question of your successor. Now, it is the case that First Sea Lords, broadly speaking, choose their successor.
Yes.
Without pretty much any interference, generally speaking.
Yes.
And it's also the case that you had that normally you have you're grooming one or two candidates from which the current First Sea Lord will groom one or two candidates, or certainly be considering one or two candidates. Will that be the case? And was that the case with you?
Yes. And that's important because you never know, I use the phrase figuratively, your prime choice might go under a bus. And so it's as well to be to have a fallback.
And of course, you did have a prime choice. So you changed the contents of the envelope.
I did, yes. But that was, I forget exactly when it was. I think it was certainly 6 months, if not a year. Certainly 6 months before handover date. And that was really for a different reason. It was no catastrophe. It was just a set of circumstances which related to the other person's suitability, in my judgment, and so forth.
So that was quite late in your period, as the changing of the contents of the envelope would have occurred then. Very late 81, early 82, because your original handover date, if it was 6 months before your handover date,
would have been July 82.
In theory, would have been July.
Yes.
So, Admiral Fieldhouse came into the frame quite late in the day.
Yes.
Right.
Well, came into the prime nomination.
Yes. 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 And then he ended up taking over 5 months later than perhaps he thought he might do. So he stayed.
Yes, but I kept him in fully in touch about this.
Okay.
No, it wasn't 5 months. It was more like.
Or July. Well,
I suppose it was. Yes. Yes.
Roughly.
4 months. Four months, because it was the 1st of December.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
And he. And even if I'd got my way, it would have been the end of January when John Knott went. But that was too much for John Knott.
Oh, did you know that John Knott was going to go at the end of January?
I can't remember at what point I did. It came out, I think it was after I had actually pulled out. I think it was. It was irrelevant then, because his mind was quite made up. And indeed, I think he'd only achieved that stay of execution by making it hard 1st of December.